This is KBOO Portland. Coming up is an encore presentation of Preference, but first these messages.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work, to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle. Every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
They didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth. She is an animal rights activist, a rescuer, marine biologist, and a conservationist. You can catch this episode of Voices for the Animals on December 27th at 10 a.m. right here on KBOO, or anytime after the 27th on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, also on Google Play and iTunes.
When disco spreads like a bacteria. Welcome to Preference. That was Alcazar, Swedish pop supergroup. the music underneath is Spacer from Sheila and be devotion. Welcome. I'm your host, Hedda. I am glad to be here. Thanks to Miles and Somia working in the booth to bring us onto the air today. We have Stephanie Scora on the line. Is that correct?
Yes. Hi. Hello.
Hi there. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. I'm very, very happy. I've been looking forward to talking with you for quite a while, actually.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. I should let folks know that, my voice is a little rough today. I was exposed to a chemical that has poisoned my body. And so I've been sick for a while. And hopefully one of these days my body will flush it out and I'll be back on my feet. I've had to make some changes in my life to recover. So here I am, pushing along. So thanks to everybody who's been patient and supportive. Stephanie, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, so my name is Stephanie Scora. Pronouns are she, her, and hers. I am an anti-Zionist Jewish woman, an anti-Zionist Ashkenazi Jewish woman, a femme lesbian. I am a genderqueer trans woman, and I do organizing around Palestine solidarity, liberation for trans folks, racial justice, and anti-pink washing.
Wonderful.
Among other things.
Yeah. I am also an anti-Zionist Jew. And this is a conversation I like to keep going. We've had different folks on the air over the years to talk about it, and of course it's always timely and maybe more so right now.
Certainly.
I've been flipping through Sarah Schulman's book this week, Israel, Palestine, and the Queer International. Sarah really talks about sort of the process of her getting educated and learning to meet folks and hear their point of view about Palestinian rights and about what Palestinian queer life is really like, you know, instead of this just this stereotyped that Arab or Muslim countries are just gruesome and brutal to queer and trans folks, but it's much more nuanced than that in people's experience. And of course,
certainly,
you know, when we talk about pink washing, we talk about what could definitely be characterized, I think, as an ongoing campaign as part of I think Israel's broader public relations campaign to sell itself as this pluralistic democracy, a beacon of Western civilization, I guess, and enlightenment, in this, you know, sea of maybe infidels, I guess you could say, is Israel's point of view on that.
That is certainly how they would put it. Yeah.
And of course, it's more complicated than that for queer and trans Israelis. Whatever their, you know, whatever their background, whatever their religion, whatever their ethnicity, so it's more complex than this than Israel would like you to believe. And I think folks are not, you know, it isn't an especially the pink washing part of it where queer and trans folks are sort of co-opted into being part of it. We are brought in, I think, as props to you know, through our culture and through other aspects of
certainly
queer life and you know, and Jewish life, to stand in for how inclusive and welcoming and brilliant Israel is when it comes to pluralism and humanism and welcoming. And just this week, the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland sent out their email inviting folks, queer folks in particular, to travel to Israel and see what it's about. See if
gross.
Let me see if I can dig that up because I thought it was pretty...
Was it particularly through a wider bridge, or was it just on like one of those LGBT birthright trips?
I don't think it wasn't. It didn't involve a wider bridge, and I don't even think it was a birthright trip specifically. It was specifically. Let's see if I can find it. it shouldn't be hard because I sent rather a sharp response. So here we go. one that I could not repeat on the air. So here we go.
Those are always the best kind.
So here, let me read this. This is from the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Why did this? And so I'm going to read part of this email directly. Why do we think you should come to Israel? Because it is one of the most beautiful, magical, unique, and complicated places on earth, and there is no way to understand the issues in the area without seeing it for yourself. Why are we writing to you in particular? Because you have expressed support for or participation in the LGBTQ community. As members of the LGBTQ community, we are particularly committed to the hard work and struggles of the Jewish and non-Jewish LGBTQ community in Israel. The Portland Federation has been supporting some of these organizations for many years. As part of this tour, we plan to meet with some of those Israeli LGBTQ members and hear about their experiences and the work that they are doing. So that's actually pretty banal. Other than the $4,000 price tag, which of course they will loan you money to pay for. And so, so it isn't specific to you know, a wider bridge or any other organization that's involved in, I want to say, recruiting queer Americans to stand in for Israel. But I do think it's a softer approach to bringing queer and trans folks in as props. I really think that that's... that's what it is. We would, to participate in those kinds of activities, we would physically be become representatives of so-called Israeli pluralism.
Well, we're asked in many ways to tokenize ourselves on behalf of, you know, the Israeli state and Zionism as a larger political project. There's this idea that as queer and trans people, there's this idea that's peddled to us, not necessarily an idea that exists independently on its own, but certainly something that is intentionally peddled to queer and trans people through emails like the ones that you just read, where there's this idea that Israel is this thing, that is something that queer and trans people should be inherently concerned with and about and for. And it is this entity that invites us to come and tokenize ourselves on its behalf, and to stand in and give testimonial about how supposedly wonderful it is and how great and safe we feel there. When in reality, it is little more than clever propaganda. And selling it's selling a vacation. It's selling a tourist falsehood that's been very meticulously manufactured to provide a good experience to people who want to go on vacation but never actually have to deal with any of the complexities that exist for queer and trans people within the Israeli context and within the greater global context as it concerns Israel.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, everyone who has participated in or taken a look, you know, a close look at these sorts of trips to Israel notes that the folks who you would meet with on a trip like this, those are selected. I mean, you don't get a list and you get to wander around. Your interactions are scripted and they're scheduled and so it's just sort of decided ahead of time what kinds of conversations you're going to participate in and what kinds of viewpoints that you're gonna be exposed to. So let us let's talk about a wider bridge. I think that's a great place to take a closer look at how this plays out in our land. Mm-hmm. Do you want to?
Yes, indeed. All right.
Yeah. Do you want to kick that off?
Yeah, I think so. A wider bridge is, most simply put, they're a pinkwashing organization, although they would deny that vehemently. They were founded, began operations in 2012, essentially as an organization that seeks to gain the support of the LGBTQ community in the United States for Israel, and basically to get LGBTQ people to be invested politically and personally in Israel and in Israeli politics under the guise of helping LGBT Israelis. Now, really, that's not what's going on. This is a wider bridge is actually just a pro-Israel organization that exists to get LGBT support for Israel, not necessarily by supporting Israeli LGBT people, but by, you know, dangling them as enticing sideshows to attract LGBT people from the U.S. to their events. And they do this with the support of a bevy of institutional funders, currently all of whom that are public fund right-wing groups, pro-Israel campus organizations which perform right-wing activities, illegal settlement organizations, or just straight out Republicans. And a wider bridge, like, it's even in their tagline. Their tagline is equality in Israel and equality for Israel. And I think that really says all you need to know about a wider bridge is that they are themselves to be. They are an organization that pretends to care about the interests of LGBTQ people, so that they can care very intensely about the image of the Israeli state and utilize LGBTQ people and our political involvement to advance the interests of the Israeli state within the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to introduce it. Part of their tagline, equality for Israel. What do you hear in that?
I mean, well, I think anybody who's familiar with anti-Zionist rhetorics and even with Zionist rhetorics would recognize this particular claim that they're trying to allude to here is equality for Israel alludes to this idea that somehow Israel is treated unfairly. Or singled out for discrimination, or targeted unfairly, or any number of things. Ostensibly, it marks them as an anti-BDS org, and an org that exists to counteract Palestinian claims made against the Israeli state and the Palestinian movement for freedom and justice for themselves by portraying Israel as this unduly set upon state, which is the subject of all sorts of discrimination and anti-Semitism and unfair treatment on the international stage, when in reality we know that that's not true. Any observer who bothered to look at the actual facts in play here would realize that, you know, Israel has gotten off with a pretty good deal considering all the things that the state of Israel has done to the indigenous Palestinian people and even to their own population, even to Israelis. The treatment of non-Orthodox Jews in Israel is not stellar, and the treatment of Mizrahi Jews and Black Jews is just atrocious.
Hmm.
And a wider bridge's claim, their goal of equality for Israel, is essentially a clever way of saying, oh, please don't pay attention to the bad things that Israel does. Israel loves gay people. Look, there are gay people that live here. Please don't pay attention to anything else. It's the essence of pinkwashing, is trying to cover up all of the abuses of the Israeli state by focusing on its, mediocre record on LGBTQ rights and portraying Israel itself as a victim.
I should mention, not only is Sarah Shulman's book a nice introduction to the topic of pinkwashing and queer solidarity with Palestinian rights, but another place that folks can look, this is a film that Kabu hosted maybe a year and a half ago at the Clinton Street Theater, Pinkwashing Exposed, a story of Seattle activists attempting to sway Seattle city government to cancel a pinkwashing event.
Yes.
And their first...
An event actually partially sponsored by a wider bridge.
Mm-hmm. There we go. You're in Chicago, isn't it?
Yes, I'm based out of Chicago.
And there is Pinkwashing Exposed actually showing in Chicago? It is, isn't it?
It can. Dean Spade, who made the movie, Dean shows it everywhere, but mm-hmm. also it's available for free online.
Oh, wonderful.
So you can have a showing of Pinkwashing Exposed anywhere that you would like to, even if it's just a showing for one in your living room on your laptop.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it really is. It's an essential educational piece.
It is showing in April in Minneapolis. That's what I was thinking of.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So what are you making out of this sudden clash about Israel's influence in U.S. politics, and sort of where we fit in? You know, do you think that we're going to continue to be dragged in as props, or is the fight so large that we're actually on the margins of it, and it's something so much bigger? Which I think is probably true at this moment. And so, being able to bring attention to all of the ways that this pinkwashing, which is a great term and also, one we should keep... keep talking about what we mean by it, bringing queer and trans folks in to stand in for... what is alleged to be Israeli democracy and pluralism, and American and Canadian queer and trans folks, I think in particular, have been subject to this, and so there are a lot of different places that plays out on campuses, film festivals. I think queer film festivals, I think, are a place where this activity is taking place. You know, I think the Israeli government is subsidizing films where it can and getting them out there and getting them accepted to film festivals. And so propaganda can be obvious, of course.
It takes many forms, yeah.
Yeah. What else do you see happening?
Yeah, I think those are all really interesting questions because of, the nature of the debate that's going on right now in particular. I think, if we want to take the larger view of this debate and see it as the particular targeting of Black people for their solidarity with Palestine, I think that it's only a matter of time before the next big target of a right-wing Zionist backlash is a Black queer or trans person, simply because there are so many Black queer and trans people that are in very firm and very comprehensive solidarity with Palestine. It's inevitable that one of them will be targeted rather viciously soon. But I think, and when that time comes, I think conversations about pinkwashing and the role of queer and trans people in particular in this community and in this struggle will be brought to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the most recent iteration of this discussion in terms of, what is the Israeli government's influence in the U.S. government, what is the pro-Israel lobby's influence in the U.S. government. I think it raises a number of interesting questions for queer and trans people, because certainly this is a debate that we should be concerned about. Certainly, I think that anybody who has, anybody who knows what's going on would know that the pro-Israel lobby, and not just AIPAC, but certainly the United States Chamber of Commerce, which is an organization that performs anti-BDS and pro-Israel actions regularly, and CUFI, Christians United for Israel, which are actually the two largest pro-Israel lobbying organizations, and AIPAC is rather distant in comparison to their size. They hold a very large and outsized influence in U.S. government. But I think because of the way that queer and trans people are marginalized by the state and by governments inherently, like Western-style neoliberal colonial governments inherently, the ways in which we're pushed to the margins and excluded from systems of governance, also raising questions on whether or not we would like to participate in systems of governance in the first place, because the government will never really be our savior. I think you know, it's interesting to see where we fit into this larger conversation, because there are not very many LGBTQ people in government, and the current debate over influence in regards to Israel in the U.S. government excludes queer and trans people because of that, because we're excluded from government in the first place. And I think, you know, maybe while there have been a lot of queer and trans people who have issued rather incisive critiques of the things that have been happening to Ilhan Omar, and just the horrible, horrible hate that she has received, I think the film festivals that you brought up and more the cultural aspect are really where queer and trans people in the Palestine Solidarity Movement have our time to shine, because of the ways that society regulates different oppressed groups of people into different spaces based on, you know, stereotypes and perceptions of what we are good for, in the interests of the state. Queer and trans people often are shoved into the role of culture creators and cultural content creators. And so in that role, we have an incredibly important and valuable opportunity to disrupt pro-Israel and general Zionist influences in film festivals, in cultural production spheres, in cultural influence spheres, because we have extreme access to these spaces in many ways. We create many of these spaces as queer and trans people, and in particular film festivals. Like, you know, what is theater, what is film without the gays? is a quote that I've been hearing more and more recently. Is, you know, it's certainly something, but it's not very good. And I think, you know, we as oppressed people have a duty to stand with all other oppressed people, including Palestinians. And I really think that it is in the best interest of every queer and trans person everywhere in the world to be in solidarity with the Palestinian liberation movement and the Palestinian struggle for justice. And I think part of that is by making sure that what are essentially propaganda films, whether they be pinkwashing propaganda films or propaganda films that take another pro-Israel tack, are not given uncritical space to air their claims in these cultural spaces and in cultural spheres of influence. And I think in a lot of ways that work has started to happen already. There's this whole boycott Eurovision movement that has really gotten a lot of support from queer and trans people worldwide, because the gays love Eurovision. And Eurovision, the European Song Contest, it's like big EU American Idol plus like a few other countries, because Europe.
Right, and Israel is hosting later this year.
Yeah, Israel's hosting this year. And there has been a huge, huge movement to boycott Eurovision, and many of the leaders of that are queer and trans, because the gays love Eurovision, and because this is an area in which queer and trans people can have an outsized impact, because we have an outsized presence in cultural production spaces.
Now, it's worth noting, and although it probably isn't surprising, Israel at present is threatening to bar the Eurovision winners from individual countries whose whose performers have been critical of Israel. They're you know, Israel is saying, we just might not let you into the country. So you kind of
yes,
know,
I heard about that.
Which I suppose they, you know, they the nation has a right, the state has a right, I suppose, to decide that. And I hope that even the threat alone will bring more attention to what it is that Israel's really after here.
Certainly. And also, you know, what a deeply democratic thing to do is to ban music performers for their politics from your country.
Mm-hmm.
For the only democracy in the Middle East, TM, to engage in these sorts of actions, I think they're really just, they're putting their true selves on display more and more every day.
Yeah. Well, and I think we can say that their true selves are evolving.
Well, I'm not sure if I would give Israel that much credit.
I think I would give all of us that much credit, actually. I think we're all developing, and some of us learn things that make us more open to other people's experience and how to treat them with respect in a broad sense, not just interpersonally. And other folks learn different lessons. how much are we hardwired to be the people we are, and how much are we, you know, learning as we go along and shaping ourselves?
Well, these are the questions. These are the questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's also worth noting when we're talking about cultural creation. In this country, Jews are also very central to both theater and
absolutely
the creation of movies. So it's this potentially very charged place. I think theater more so because it's so much of it is locally produced, so you can interact more easily with the folks participating.
It puts queer and trans Jews in a very interesting position. Because, you know, to be a trans anti-Zionist Jew is one of the more difficult things that a person can do, because it means being forced to choose between either conditional acceptance upon part of your identity and being able to remain in a mainstream Jewish community, which really doesn't understand that identity at all. Like, you know, mainstream Jewish communities talk a good game about being LGBTQ friendly, and really I would give mainstream American Judaism enough credit to say that for lesbian and gay and bisexual people, the big movements of American Judaism, probably from like traditional and conservative and reform and reconstructionist Judaism, perhaps not orthodoxy. But the other major movements of Judaism in the United States more or less get it when it comes to LGB people. Now, trans people are another thing entirely. I don't really think that there is a part of Judaism, mainstream American Judaism, that has quite figured out what to do about trans people and the fact that we exist. And, you know, I've been part of synagogues where there were openly gay and openly lesbian and openly bisexual members of the congregation, and they had no problem at all. But when, you know, one child in the congregation came out as trans, suddenly it was a scandal. And I think that this is a common thread in the experience of trans Jews in the diaspora, and in the U.S. and in Canada in particular, is that institutionalized Judaism doesn't really quite know what to do with trans people. And so to be anti-Zionist and trans and Jewish, you're forced to make a choice between hiding your politics on Palestine and getting conditional acceptance based on, you know, pretending to be pro-Israel, or even just deciding to be pro-Israel so that you can remain in that community, and sort of be uplifted as this trans token for Israel. Or you can choose to stand by your politics, if those are your politics, or to acquire better politics, and stand with Palestinians, and also be trans and also be Jewish, in which case you're faced with rejection and ejection from a very vast majority of mainstream U.S. and Canadian Jewish spaces, not just because you're trans, but also because you're anti-Zionist, and that simply won't do. And there's no reason for them to keep you around because you're already weird, because you're already trans. And it's just, it's one problem too many, and that problem just happens to be Israel. And it's a very catch-22 situation, and it's a very difficult situation. And I think not enough time is spent talking about what kind of sacrifices it entails inherently to be anti-Zionist and trans and Jewish in the U.S. and in Canada.
Mm-hmm. The Oregon Jewish magazine toes an absolute sort of quiet and steady pro-Israel line, and the rest of Jewish life apparently consists of meals and shopping.
Right.
I want to take a quick detour to a related subject, which is the experience that I think a lot of Methodists are having right now, as the church, the international church, the International Methodist Church, tackled the question of expanding gay rights or continuing to limit recognition of gay sexuality, the more conservative folks won votes fairly narrowly, actually. There's a whole series of votes, and they were there were some ties in there among hundreds of people, and the conservatives are buoyed by, in particular, African Methodist delegations who are strongly opposed to gay sexuality. And so I just want to mention those queer and trans Methodists who are struggling with a church that has spoken against them this month, and other broad, what are often called mainstream American churches have broken on just this issue. So it is possible that there will be a movement for more accepting delegations or conferences in the broader Methodist Church to separate, so that they
Certainly.
Can set their own policy. And I just wanted to mention that.
I do think that's it's an interesting scenario that's going on in the Methodist Church right now, which is as you've mentioned, there were these series of votes, and ultimately, I think it's advantageous to point out that it was not simply the larger church choosing between accepting LGBTQ people as full members of the church or not, but it was the church being asked to choose between accepting LGBTQ people as full members of the church or making a decision that they know would splinter the church, that would lead to the destruction of the church. And faced with that choice, they chose the destruction of the church rather than the acceptance of LGBTQ people.
Hmm. That's well put.
Mm-hmm.
No,
I think. You,
go ahead, please.
I was just going to say is I think the other thing that brings up though is that many of the mainstream denominations of Christianity in the United States have actually advanced farther than mainstream Judaism in the United States when talking about trans issues. Because there's at least been some attempt to have a conversation about what it means to be trans, and in their case, Christian, on the specific level of that church. And what it would mean to be affirming. And, you know, many of those conversations have not turned out well. You can look at the Methodists, as we've been talking about, for an example of that conversation that did not go well institutionally, but also, you know, was the site of a number of conversations that did go well on an individual basis. But I don't think that there has been any sort of conversation in mainstream American Judaism that attempts to really grapple with how Judaism as a whole, in its institutionalized forms in the United States, has really failed trans Jews. And I think that it's interesting that in our unwillingness to have this conversation, we've actually allowed Christians to get ahead of us in this, whereas there are multiple Christian denominations that have had this conversation, but Jews just don't seem to want to have it, partially because of the way that Judaism is structured, and that there's no, you know, one part of Judaism that can tell all the rest of the parts of Judaism what to do. Mm-hmm. The ways that there is with, like, in Christianity, they have the church, and the church relegates and regulates all the other churches under that kind of church. But I just think that it's interesting that there hasn't even really been an attempt to have this larger conversation about, you know, well, what does this mean that we aren't talking about this? Like, what does it mean that we know that there are trans Jews out there who don't feel welcome? And what should we do about it? And I think that it's a real shame that that hasn't been more broadly discussed.
What do you think it would look like to get... to get that conversation to deepen?
You know, I'm not even really sure, because I think in many ways there are a few things that you just cannot have conversations about in mainstream American Jewish spaces, because they're issues that are quote unquote complicated. And by that I mean, like, these are things that, you know, if you bring them up and you get to a certain point in the conversation where you're actually asking about change, the answer that comes up is immediately, like, some sort of hand-wavy, oh, this is very complicated, or, like, this is too complicated, let's talk about it later. And those things are largely in order: Palestine, wealth, and gender. You can't really have conversations about gender that go deeper than acknowledging the fact that there are women who are rabbis, which even in some spaces is a bit of a controversy. You cannot have conversations about how cultures of wealth and expectations of wealth rule American Jewish spaces in a way that we are completely unprepared to talk about. From everything to how every part of the mainstream Jewish experience costs thousands of dollars to actually engage in, to the fact that you have to pay for tickets to go to high holiday services.
Mm-hmm.
And then certainly Palestine, like, you know, it's bordering upon impossible to have an institutional level conversation about Palestine in many mainstream American Jewish spaces, because people just don't want to hear it, for any number of reasons. And I think that, you know, these three things, by not talking about them, certainly they're intertwined, but also we're doing a massive disservice to ourselves as Jews, as a people, to just refuse to talk about what it means, even what it means that we won't grapple with these things, that we're unwilling as a larger community to have these serious conversations about not just Palestine, but about gender and about wealth and about inequity in our communities, in a way that actually could create and foment change. And I think that really when our community is forced to come to terms with one or more of these things in a public way, the others might follow soon after.
This is Preference, and we're talking with Stephanie Scora. I want to remind folks that one doesn't have to be Jewish to support Palestinian rights, or queer or trans to oppose pinkwashing. I think that can that this kind of conversation can actually seem insular and circular, And it isn't meant to be.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, in for sure, you do not need to be Jewish or Palestinian to take a stance on Palestinian human rights. I think that that's actually one of the more insidious tropes that's being thrown around, sometimes under the guise of progressivism, is that this is just a thing that Jews and Palestinians have to sort out by ourselves and nobody else can have an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually, that's a stance that's being advanced in some like progressive places, and I think that that's incredibly dangerous. And, you know, the fact that LGBTQ people need allies has been long played out, like people know about that. But I think that that's really important to bring up, of course.
Stephanie, what do you think queer and trans solidarity with Palestinians looks like at this point? How can people live that out? I do want to mention again Sarah Shulman's book, Israel, Palestine, and the Queer International. Not all of us have access to the kind of resources that Sarah Shulman has. So that's not necessarily an experience folks can reach for. But what can we do?
You know, I think that's a very good question. I think there are levels to what is ideal as opposed to what is possible to expect.
Mm-hmm.
I think something that any queer or trans person could do to advance the cause of justice for Palestine would be to just simply insist upon having the conversation in queer and trans spaces. One of the biggest reasons why pro-Israel politics and sentiment are allowed to thrive in queer and trans spaces is because people just won't talk about Palestine or are afraid to talk about Palestine. And I think by insisting upon having that conversation, we can do a lot to change that. I think just making sure that Palestine is discussed and discussed fairly and discussed accurately in any queer and trans space is integral to larger queer and trans support for Palestinian human rights. I think beyond that, actively educating yourself on pinkwashing so that you can be ready to combat it, actively educating yourself on the real situations of queer and trans people who are citizens of the Israeli state and queer and trans Palestinians and their experiences and what they want us to do would certainly be, I would say, step 1A. If talking about it at all is step 1, centering the experiences of queer and trans Palestinians is step 1A, where we can't really... This is a solidarity movement for those of us who are not Palestinian, and we have to be beholden to the things that queer Palestinians want us to do, and largely those are combat pinkwashing and make sure that the experiences of queer and trans Palestinians are talked about and talked about accurately and not talked about in a way that shows other Palestinians in an unduly negative light. Like, we shouldn't gloss over the fact that there is indeed homophobia and transphobia in many Palestinian cultural spaces and in many places within Palestine, because those are real things that queer and trans Palestinians face. But we should also acknowledge that, like, yes, people in Palestinian communities have problems with homophobia and transphobia, but so do people in every other community as well.
Mm-hmm.
Disrupting this narrative that homophobia and transphobia are something that is unique to Arab or Muslim communities, or particularly severe in Arab or Muslim communities, is something very essential that other queer and trans people can do by pointing out that homophobia and transphobia exist wherever there are people. These are, you know, universal products of white supremacy and colonization. And considering that Palestine is an area that has experienced a lot of colonization, as has, you know, most of Southwest Asia and North Africa, it would be a very extreme level of expectation to hold people who live in those areas to this idea that they must be free of homophobia and transphobia in order to deserve rights. Homophobia and transphobia are cogs in a larger, more insidious wheel of oppression that is white supremacy, that is colonization. And, you know, we can't absolve people who are homophobic and transphobic of their homophobia and transphobia, but we also can't condemn them solely upon it. Because to condemn them and to condemn Palestinians based on this idea that they're that Palestinians or Muslims or people who are perceived to be Muslim or Palestinian are homophobic would mean to condemn all Palestinian people.
Yeah, indeed.
Including queer and trans Palestinian people.
Indeed, and I think it also, you know, I think it hints that folks are incapable of change, and that they themselves are, permanently at fault. It's not quite what I mean to say, but it's something close to it. Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Blessings to you. I want to play a little music. It needs a bit of intro. There's a law in India called Section 377. It talks about different kinds of prohibited sexual acts. Last year, the Supreme Court of India struck down the part of this section, this law that criminalizes homosexual intercourse. And so this piece of music was released earlier this year, and I'm going to just read a little bit about this piece of music that I have chosen to bring to you. This is from the New Indian Express. Post the decriminalization of Section 377 in September 2018, the heart comprises colors that define LGBTQIA+ society. Making Valentine's Day, which is when this was released, extra sweet, is Mumbai-based gender-fluid artist and LGBTQIA+ activist Pragya Pallavi's and Malayali queer activist Deepa Vasudevan's song Lingering Wine from their album Queerism, India's first queer-based album. And the video is very sweet. It is, as this article says, a celebration of lesbian love, involving queer and trans women as the production crew. Lingering Wine is the song from the record Queerism. Enjoy, folks. Thank you so much for listening.
using the slice of your bite. Hey, hey, hey. The dreams that I chase, longing for you.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Fixing Your City, creating thriving neighborhoods and adapting to a changing world. On Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland. Fixing Your City, Creating Thriving Neighborhoods and Adapting to a Changing World, is a book release and talk by urban architect George Crandall. He'll discuss Portland growth, congestion, and global warming, and identify steps the community can take.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got four requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Favorite radio show, Calculated Conversation, and we back. We're not going to tell you what day it is, but we will tell you it's the Christmas Eve show.
It's the eve of the Christmas.
Yeah, when you hear it, it'll be Christmas Eve. So we here. I'm your host, David J.
I'm Ken Jones.
We definitely in the comfort, so you might not be able to call in specifically on this show, but please, you can still call in, but we won't be there.
Right.
But leave a message. Hit us on the socials, Facebook at the Calculated Conversation Radio Show.
Uh-huh.
IG, Calculated Conversation, Twitter at Calculated Talk.
Bam.
We also on the Gmail at calculatedconversation@gmail.
Mm-hmm.
And we on the website at www.calculatedconversation.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we are on iTunes.
iTunes.
And we on Google Play Store.
Yes.
And we are in your mind.
Hey,
all on your mind. So we do understand it's the holidays. We coming to the end of an amazing year. We wanted to kind of get into a little bit about gratitude and some of the things and people and places we thankful for that's allowed us to do some of the things that we've done, you right. know. And so we want to end it out with an appreciation show.
Yes, yeah.
Before we get on that, man, what up, Cam?
Hey, not too much.
That was smooth. That was some Cam White type stuff.
That was a
very Cam White.
Hey, lower the octave a little bit. yeah, it ain't been too much. Today was a nice slow flow into the week. What I did have happen Saturday, the woke team, we got invited to do a workshop at the Northwest Vietnamese Student Association Summit. The Catalyst for Change is what the theme was.
I think I seen that.
Yeah,